Okay, we just finished here. 4 in 10,000 are presumed to be mutations, but they are a result of a loss of functionality. Let's do a little mathematics here. Related mutations. Now, if you're going to have mutations that are great new information and great new features, they have to be related. Okay, mathematics. Mutations occur about 1 in every 10 million duplications. Scientific notation, 10 to the 7th. That's 1 followed by 7 zeros there. Okay, we're not going to do any hard math here. That's the probability of getting one, what they call, beneficial mutation. To get 2 related beneficial mutations, the probability is 10 to the 7th times 10 to the 7th. In that mathematics, you add the exponents. So that would be 10 to the 14th power, the possibility of getting 2 beneficial related mutations. That's 1 in 100 trillion. That doesn't look too good. 2 beneficial mutations is not going to change anything. To get 3 related beneficial mutations is 10 to the 21st power, or 1 in a billion trillion possibilities. 4 is 10 to the 28th power. That's a number that looks like that. That's just 4, and that's not going to do much, folks. So,
explain to me what this mutation is. Is this a one-time event?
Yes.
So just to get one
beneficial related mutation.
So it's not something that sticks that I can build on later.
No.
It's just to do
if it's not inheritable,
right,
then it's lost.
Right. So you're saying just to get one cell one time.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep, that's it. This doesn't look good when you look at it this way, does it? That's why they don't like to use these in classrooms. 4 beneficial related mutations isn't going to do much at all. And the possibilities of getting that are not good.
And by related mutations, you mean that 2, 3, 4 mutations that would help each other out.
Right. In other words, if we're going to go from scales to feathers, we want to start growing feathers. 4 isn't going to do much of anything. A feather is a very complex mechanism. Or if we want to go 8 to human, that's a pretty big change. You know, if we were only 3% different from the apes, they talk about 2% difference. We're only 3% difference. That's 90 million differences. They don't use that number in the school classroom either. But in fact, they teach 2%. The number now is close to 20%. They've discovered that we're not even close. When they came up with the 2% difference between us and chimpanzees, they hadn't even figured out the full genome yet. They only covered part of the genome. Now that they've looked at both the genomes, it's up to about 20% difference between us and apes. We're not even close, folks. We're closer to watermelons. All right, let's talk about this one. Natural selection, what is it? Charles Darwin. It may be said that natural selection is daily and hourly scrutinizing throughout the world every variation, even the slightest, rejecting that which is bad, preserving and adding up all that is good, silently and insensibly working whenever and wherever opportunity arises. According to Charles Darwin, whatever natural selection is, it does scrutinizing. It rejects those things which are bad, so it has decision-making power, and preserves and adds up all that's good. In other words, whatever natural selection is, according to Charles Darwin, it has intelligence. So it's pretty smart, whatever it is. Here's Life Sciences textbook. Over a long period of time, natural selection can lead to evolution. Helper variations gradually accumulate species while unfavorable ones disappear. Folks, that doesn't tell me what natural selection is at all, does it? I want to know what is it and how does it work. I don't see that in any textbooks. What I see is natural selection causes evolution. That is not a definition. Critical thinking in natural selection. Natural selection, natural means caused by what? Nature, natural processes. Selection implies what? A selector or intelligence. So whatever intelligence is, nature's doing it. Let me go through some things now. How many here do not like hot climates? Okay. Pastor Joe, you're going to be transferred to Death Valley. where it gets up above 120 in the summertime. I would love to live there. I wouldn't be married anymore, though. Will you survive? Yes, you will. You may not like it a lot, but you're going to survive. But after 6 months there, you're going to get acclimated. 90 degrees, you might be wearing a heavy jacket. You'll adjust, won't you? How many don't like cold climates? That's me. Okay, we're going to send you to the Arctic. Will you survive?
Barely.
Barely. But after a while, 30 degrees out, you're going to be wearing shorts, aren't you? In other words, your body's going to adjust. It'll adjust. What's happening there? Did you evolve?
Cold combination.
No. The hot and cold are something you got exposed to. Does hot and cold have any intelligence? Does the weather have any intelligence? Do rocks have any intelligence? No. What allowed you to adjust? Let me do one more then. Okay. We're going to send you to the top of Pikes Peak tomorrow. We're going to take a helicopter or a tram. There's a tram goes up. And as soon as you get to the top of Pikes Peak, 14,110 feet high, we want you to run around as fast as you can. What's going to happen? You're going to probably pass out. You're going to get sick. You're going to get altitude sickness. It's not going to feel very good. But after a couple months up there, you run around. Things are normal. What happened? You adjusted. The question is, what allowed you to adjust? Did the altitude do anything? Did it make any decisions for you? No. What is happening, folks? It's your DNA. It's the pre-programmed information in your DNA that allows you to adjust. God has programmed into our DNA the ability to adjust to different environments within limits. Let me give you an illustration of that. We're going to send you, you like swimming? Okay. You're going to go to the deep end of the pool and sit down there for an hour with no equipment. Will you survive? No. Because God has given us limits to what we can adjust to. Okay? We're going to send you on a spacewalk with no spacesuit. Will you survive? No. Because again, we've got pre-programmed information as to adjust to different environments within limits. Could you survive in 200-degree weather? No, because it's within limits. If you're out in weather that is 50 below without any protection on it, will you survive? Absolutely not. You'll freeze to death. Now, I might survive in 200 degrees. I love heat. When you preheat the oven to 350, I put my arms in there and just enjoy it. I love it. It just feels comfortable, 350 degrees. I am proof we evolved from lizards. My wife has names for me. But I love that the heat. It just feels so good putting your arms in there, 350. Pre-programmed information. Now, let me take this to the next step. You're in a car. The speed limit is 60. And you're going 60 miles an hour, and you got your cruise control on, and you approach this hill. As your car starts going up the hill, it initially begins to slow down, doesn't it? But then all of a sudden, it'll speed back up to 60. Did the hill make any decisions there to speed your car up? No, the hill is something you got exposed to. What is happening? There's a sensor inside your car that recognizes the speed is slowing down, sends a signal to the other part of the car, speed up. That's exactly what's happening there. The hill makes no decisions at all there. We have sensors inside cars. Same thing for planes. They have their ground radar on, and they start approaching a mountain. So what happens to their elevation? It tends to get lower and lower and lower as they start approaching that mountain more. But there's a sensor inside that plane that says something's wrong with the altitude. You're too low. Sends a signal to another part of the plane that raises up the altitude. That is exactly how the body works. Your body has sensors all over it. And these sensors sense different situations, different environments, and they will send signals to other parts of your body that allow you to adjust to environments such as heat, cold, altitudes, and other environments. In other words, our bodies work very much like machines we are building today. They're now teaching courses on this at some of the secular universities in the engineering and biomechanics section, environment classes, that our bodies are very much like machines in that sense. We have sensors everywhere sending signals constantly to different parts of the body, adjusting to situations. In other words, it has nothing to do with natural selection. Nothing at all. As a matter of fact, there is no such thing as natural selection. It is the information that God has already programmed into your DNA that allows you to adjust, because nothing new is ever being added. If natural selection did work, it does not add anything to the body. Natural selection, the way the evolution explained it, can only select from what's already there. So where's new information come from if it's not mutations? Can't. When you come across somebody who's talking about natural selection, here's the three questions you will ask. What is natural selection and how does it work? Number two. Selection implies intelligence. Could you tell me who or what is your intelligence doing this selecting? Boy, that just blows them up right there. Charles Darwin thought it was the environment. I didn't know the environment had intelligence. It doesn't. Now, this question puts the evolutionist into a lose-lose situation. Why? If they answer the environment, they're wrong, because the environment doesn't have intelligence. Rocks don't speak. Wind doesn't have any intelligence. But if they give the correct answer, they also lose. What? Yes. We can put the evolutionists into a lose-lose situation. See, if they give the correct information, say it's the information in our DNA, now we will invoke our power question to them. Can you show me any observational evidence where that vast amount of information in our DNA came from that does not require me to use faith? The only answer they can give is over millions and millions of years, new information built up. Did anybody ever observe millions of years? No. It's a faith issue. That's all millions of years means. What millions of years means is they do not have the observable evidence, just believe me. That's what millions of years means. It's hiding the real evidence. They don't have it. So they're in a lose-lose situation at that point. Any observational evidence where that vast amount of information in our DNA came from that does not require me to use faith, they cannot answer that. I asked for observable. You did not give it to me. I already have a faith. Tell me about your faith, and I'll tell you about my faith in Jesus Christ. This is what we need to be teaching our children. I have not met very many high school teachers that have a clue what natural selection really is. All they've been taught is it creates evolution. They've never thought this thing through. Who or what is the intelligence doing this? So what is natural selection? It's an artificial mechanism devised by man to replace God. That's what natural selection is. Why? Because according to evolutionists, all the diversity of life on this planet was caused by natural selection. I thought God did that. Do you see now that natural selection is replacement for God? So somebody comes up to you and says, do you believe in natural selection? If you say yes, what have you just told the evolutionist? You don't believe in God. But what you will do, you will not answer that question. You'll say, well, I'm very interested in natural selection. Tell me what it is and how does it work? Then you go to the second question. Well, natural selection seems to imply intelligence. Tell me who or what is your intelligence so to help me understand this more.
What if they, which someone has asked me before, well, how do you know who created God? Mm-hmm. So what do you say to them?
That's a good one. And I answer that one. Who created God? Can we hold on to that one until the end?
Okay.
But I do answer it in the advanced one day class.
Oh.
You have to go back and pay more money. No. I watch too many commercials. Now, we have answers to that. From a Christian, God is what? A self-existing being. He was not created. He always existed. I am. Exactly. That's what the I am. To the evolutionists, they won't accept that. So what I'm going to do is show them, ask the question, going back to, where did your matter come from? And we know it can't create itself. We know it can't have always existed. So the only way the universe got here could be God had created, unless you don't want to believe in the laws of science. Now I'm going to tell where God came from. There's two choices. There's one creator God who created all things, or there's a regression of God. Who created God? A super God created God. Who created super God? A super, super God created the super God who created God. Keep going back and back and back. There's the religion out there that does that. But eventually you have to get to the original creator of all things, don't you? Then we invoke what's called the principle of Occam's razor. Principle of Occam's razor, if you got more than one possibility, choose the simplest. Choose the one with the least assumptions behind it. And that is what? There's one God and there's none like him. So that's how I'll answer that question. I just put him on the defense right away. Where'd the matter come from? And then explain to him where God came from. So what are we going to call this thing then? Well, we don't know the name of it yet. We don't know what we're going to call it with this process. Just pre-programmed information by God. He gives us all this programmed information. Intelligent designer. We do have an intelligent designer. His name's God. Created by God for a purpose. Information is pre-programmed in our DNA. So we can adapt to hot and cold. We can adapt to high altitudes. So God has pre-programmed that into all different creatures' abilities to adapt, ability to vary within kind. Just look at the variety within humankind. Billy Barty was a famous actor, 3'10", full grown. Died a couple decades ago. Was he a human being? Absolutely, 3'10". Shaquille O'Neal, 7 foot tall. Is he a human being? Yes, he's a big one, but he's a human being. Look at the tremendous genetic variability within human species alone. Different shades of skin. Does that mean different races? Absolutely not. How many races are there? One. It's called the human race. What gives us different shades of skin? Melanin. Those who have more genetic capability for melanin can have a darker shade skin. Those who have less, like myself, have a light-colored skin. In other words, you know what happens when I go out in the sun? I get pink, I get red, and I peel. I don't get any different color than this. I've lost my capability there. Any questions on natural selection? This is an important concept. It's brand new. This came out about 2 years ago. This whole idea of somebody starting to question, what is natural selection? And there's more to come on that. The Institute for Creation Research has on their website many articles written on this. On natural selection on this. How many have heard of Acts and Facts? Comes out of the Institute for Creation Research. It's got about maybe 15, 20 pages to it. It's free. You will get it. Got that? Marines don't say you should. You will get this. It's free, chock full of information. Some a little technical. You may not like that. But it's got tremendous amounts of information. And you go to the ICR website. Guess what it's called? ICR.org. ICR.org. Get your Acts and Facts. They're free. You'll get it, won't you? You already? Good, good. I've got everyone that's ever come out from the very beginning. I used to work there, too. All right, ready for the last one. Okay, we've taken care of the universe, cosmological evolution. We took care of the origin of life, which destroyed the foundation for Darwin. Then we took care of Darwin to show mutations and natural selection will not cause evolution. Now let's get to the Holy Grail. How old is the Earth? How reliable are the dating methods? Would you agree that things change over time? A lot of things change over time. We grow older, don't we? Food spoils. What happens if you leave a banana out for 6-7 days?
Somebody eats it.
Starts browning, does it? So sugars, right? Sugars? You don't throw that banana away. Now it is great for making banana bread, isn't it? Flavorful banana bread, yes. With piping hot from the oven. And you just smell that right about now, don't you? things wear out, and some elements change. In other words, some atoms or elements will change over time. Some will stay stable, some will change. For example, potassium over time changes to lead. Uranium, well, potassium changes to argon. Excuse me, potassium changes to argon, uranium to lead. Carbon-14 will change into nitrogen-14. Those are just naturally occurring things. Yeah. I'm going to summarize this chapter here for you. I'm rewriting it. You've got information here shows that there's assumptions. You've got information on other things in there, of the inaccuracies of it. But I want to make this real simple. That's why I'm rewriting this chapter. Starting next year, we'll get a difference in making it easier. There's some critical things to understand about these dating methods. They're called radiometric dating methods. Radiometric dating methods. Number one, this is how we date rocks. This is how we're supposed to be dating the age of rocks. Radiometric dating methods. We have many different tools for doing that. We listed some here. Uranium to lead. Over time, uranium changes to lead. Over time, potassium changes to argon. Rubidium changes to strontium. So we have many different techniques for doing this. Here's the key I want you to get. There's two things in here. Number one, no dating method, radiometric dating method, gives an age. None of them give an age. That's not taught. We see in our textbooks they give exact dates. Not one of them gives an age. That's an important concept. None of them do this. What we do is we use observable methods today, what we call operational science, and we can detect the number of elements in that particular rock sample. In other words, how many potassium argons, how many argon atoms we have in there, how long it takes for potassium to change into argon, and that can give us a ratio, doesn't it? Gives us a count of argon atoms. None of them give an age. What we do is based on what we observe in there through operational science, the number of atoms that this potassium is decayed into, then we infer an age. We interpret an age based on what we see. In other words, were we there when that rock formed millions of years ago? No, we weren't. No one saw that. So what we're doing is using good operational science today to try and tell us something about something that happened in history that nobody observed. You see a problem with this now. We're inferring an age based on what we see today. In other words, we're assuming something here that rock, nothing has affected it all these millions of years. We're assuming we know how it started. Can't do that. That's not science. That's speculation. So number one, none of these methods give an age. An age is inferred based on what we see in the rock today. That's not taught in the schools because that would cause some doubt. Number two, this is also critical. Every radiometric dating method is based on assumptions. They're all based on assumptions. Okay, let's take a look at some. These assumptions are in your book there. I don't know. Let's see what page they're on. Okay, assumption number one. We know the initial starting conditions of that rock. Can we say that with any accuracy if that rock was supposed to be millions of years old? No, we can't. We assume there, we know that that rock was formed, it had what we call no daughter element. Now, what do we mean by that? When potassium decays into argon, we call the parent element potassium, the daughter element, the ending element, argon. So we just use parent-daughter, daughter being the ending element. We assume when that rock was first formed, there was no daughter element in there. Can we accurately say that? No, we can't, because we've shown it wrong over and over again. For example, the Mount St. Helens rocks formed in 1980, they were dated up to 2.8 million years old.
It's probably old lava.
Yeah. We've done this on numerous occasions, taking these dates, give very old ages to very young rocks. We know when they were formed. Every time, I make this emphasis, every time that I know of, in all the research and all the journals, when we know when a rock was formed, we never get the correct age. Never. So why would we trust it when we don't know it was formed? So assumption one, we assume it was in a pure form, no daughter element in it. We have shown that to be wrong. A second assumption, we assume this rock has been in a closed system these alleged millions of years. Can we assure that? Closed system? In other words, nothing affected? No. You know what water does? It just leaches through those rocks, and guess what it does when it's leaching through there? Adds and subtracts elements all the time. So there's another assumption that has been shown to be false. Then we assume the decay rate has always been the same. In other words, how long it takes potassium to change into argon? You don't want to wait around for these things. They're millions and millions to billions of years. There's uranium to lead, we're talking billions of years there, so don't wait for that one. We assume the decay rate has always been constant. You know what we can do in the laboratory? We can change this decay rate. And they've done it. We've changed the decay rate. Also, today we have very powerful evidence that the decay rate in the past was much faster than it is today. We have very strong evidence for that. It's based on the number of helium atoms we're finding in these rocks. They shouldn't be there. Notice the decay rate had to be so fast, it didn't give enough time for helium to decay out of those rocks. Helium is like the Teflon of atoms. It doesn't stick to anything. It just migrates right out of those rocks. But we're finding an abundance of helium still in these rocks, and it shouldn't be there. The only explanation we have is the decay rate happened so fast that it didn't give the helium enough time to get out. There's been a lot of research on that. So the key here is, number one, none of these methods give an age. An age is inferred on what we see. Number two, they're all based on assumptions, and every one of these assumptions has been shown to be false. What does it tell you about the accuracy of these dating methods now? They're not even close to reliable. I know a number of nuclear physicists and physicists who've gone through these labs, done these experiments, and every one of them comes out and says, these are not reliable at all, not even close. But yet, they're teaching in school. I don't know of too many teachers that have been to these labs where they see this happen. Can I tell you what happens when you take a rock sample? When you take a rock sample to the lab, or a fossil to a lab, there's a form you fill out. Now, these are taught as exact dating forms. Give exact ages. But you take this form, and there's a little box that says, where did you find this rock sample? Why should we need to tell them that? Then there's another little box that says, what is the expected age? See what's happening there? This whole thing is biased, isn't it? A group did that. They took the Grand Canyon. We have this one in your slides. They took, and we'll end with this one. This one's pretty powerful here. They went to the Grand Canyon, down to the bottom of the Grand Canyon, Cardinia basalts, which are supposed to be the oldest rocks in the Grand Canyon. They took some samples and took them to one of the best evolutionist dating labs and did not fill out the form. And they dated the rocks by five different methods and came up with five different ages, ranging hundreds of millions of difference in their ages. That invalidates the process right there. But they chose one of them. And they chose the age to be about 1 billion years old. Why they chose that one, they didn't tell us. They didn't tell the scientists. That's just the one they chose. Then the same group of scientists went to the top of the Grand Canyon and got the youngest rocks. And they took them to the same lab and said, would you date these rocks without filling out the form? And they dated the supposed youngest rocks to be 1.4 billion years old. We see a problem there. It does not work. Over and over again, we have errors, many errors in these. And we can't use these to date the fossils. These radiometric dating methods I'm talking about can only be used to date certain kinds of rocks called igneous rocks. In other words, rocks that were once molten hot, then cool. In other words, they can't be used to date sedimentary rocks where we find most all the fossils. So how do you date the fossils? Well, carbon-14 can be used. That's what they use. But carbon-14 only has a limit of about 80,000 years, if it worked. Carbon-14 is based on an assumption which was proven false. Even the founder of carbon-14 dating, Dr. Willard Libby, in his book, noted the assumption was false and ignored it and got a Nobel Prize in chemistry. Because the assumption is false, it's been shown repeatedly to be false. Carbon-14 is only reliable up to about 3,000 years. After that, it loses its reliability. So how did they date the fossils then? Here it is. Find a fossil. This fossil is 3.2 million years old. Well, how do you know that? Because we find it in these kinds of rocks. Well, how do you know those rocks are 3.2 million years old? Because we find these kinds of fossils in them. That's exactly what they're doing in schools today. Yes?
In my geology class, they taught us the law of uniformity.
The law of uniformity. Well, most evolutionists don't buy into that anymore. Uniformitarianism. It's neo-catastrophism now. In other words, we've had many local catastrophes because we know we haven't been uniform. We can just look at the records. We've got volcanoes going off. We have hurricanes. We have earthquakes that cause tremendous devastation in area, tremendous erosion sometimes. Those are going off all throughout history. There's been more volcanic activity in history than anything occurring today. We just look at the amount of basalt, volcanic lava flows we've had out there. So to say there's a law of uniformitarianism is pleading ignorance to reality, is what I would say. I wouldn't say that to them. I would say, well, what about volcanoes and things like Mount St. Helens and hurricanes? Don't they cause tremendous change rapidly? And yes, they do. So you can't say uniformitarianism in that sense. Yes. Yeah, quite okay. Just scratching. Okay. Two things to remember about the radiometric dating. Number one, well, let's say three things. Number one, they do not give an age. An age is inferred. Number two, they are based on assumptions which have been shown to be false. Number three, every time we know when a rock was formed, we never get the correct age. It doesn't work. That's how I'm going to be rewriting this section in there. I want those three things brought out very clearly. That makes it a little bit easier than going through a whole lot of things. Okay, now, does anybody have any questions? Anybody ready for dinner? Let's see if you get to go to dinner now. You thought I was going to forget that, didn't you? Let's see if we get to go to dinner here.
Why wouldn't all rocks be the same age?
Because of the assumptions involved in radiometric dating. Just,
I mean, in reality or whatever.
In reality.
Like if we could measure ages of rocks and the Earth was roughly 6,000 years old, why?
They'll show different ages because of the water, the conditions they're in, and also volcanic rock is being created all the time, too.
So it's something about how I kind of kidded about it earlier, but I'm thinking the volcano is made out of material in the earth.
Yes.
And so wouldn't the rock still be?
Not necessarily. Because when a rock was molten hot, all the daughter element is supposed to seep out. And a lot of it does. And it starts off in a pure form. Not quite pure, we have seen, because there is traces of daughter. So based on what seeped out and what got in when it was molten lava can be different in different situations.
So ideally they would actually be able to tell a Mount St. Helens rock is only...
Yeah.
30
yes.
Years old.
Yeah. The accuracy of the radiometric dating isn't quite that good, but 2.8 is a big error. It's a big error there. So there won't be. We should be dating things that are 6,000 years or less, but we don't. They don't. Okay. Let's get to the finale. Got five questions. I got five rows here. Actually, four rows and one circle up. Can I be nice just one time? Yeah, can I be nice just once? Okay. This row right here will take question one. If they do not get it, they'll be doing push-ups. Okay. Somebody in this row must give me an answer. Three evidences the days were literal days.
A number
with the word day.
Morning and evening.
Evening and morning. Fourth commandment. They made it. So you're off the hook right now. Okay, next row. State two problems with adding millions of years into the Bible.
Death
before sin. Mark 10, verse 6. Very good. Mark 10. But from the beginning of creation, God made them male and female. Jesus would be wrong. Row number three. Why is the Genesis flood an important issue? It's foundational to what?
The gospel.
Very good. And what does it deal with?
Fossil record.
Fossil record. Very good. Thank you. Wow, we're doing pretty good. This is going to be sad if nobody does push-ups for me. Okay. Row number four. One power question. Can you give me the two key words?
Observation and faith.
Observation and faith. Very good. Now we have to the circle group.
Push-ups.
The four components of the gospel.
God, man, Christ,
and Savior. Very good. Now, I would love to have volunteers do push-ups for him because I feel like a failure if nobody does any. Okay. Thursday at Heritage Bible. Heinz Laclama, PhD in nuclear physics, going to talk about the origin of life and information. Next Saturday, Boise Bible College, the Christian Educators Conference. We have some information over there if you want to pick that up. If you don't want to go, is there somebody else that needs to go? Yeah, you can register for that. We'd like you to register so we know how much food to prepare. But if you don't know for sure, show up at the door. We'll take your money there. It's only $25 for the full day. Yeah, we're actually having the chef there prepare lunch for us. So we're going to do that. I'm not telling you, you're going to just get regular stuff. Peanut butter jelly. No, no. Okay, anybody have a final question? I'm available for questions afterward. You can call me. You can email me. I want to thank you all very much for spending your day here. Some of you might be football fans. There's still some games to go. Hope to see some of you next Saturday, maybe some of you even Thursday. Let's keep this going. Don't let it stop today. We've got Pastor Scott teaching it. We got your pastor? He's going to be teaching it. We have others going to be teaching it. Let's make this church a good model. One of the leaders in the community, standing in authority of God's word. You already have a head start on most of them. Thank you, Pastor Scott and Pastor Joe, for what you have done with this church. And God bless you. Have a great evening.